So, we're an impatient society. I mean, in terms of most people, I think when they develop stress or they get freaked out, they look for the quickest, as the Buddha said, they look for the quickest way out, the quickest solution, which generally involves alcohol or drugs or convenience, spending, or sometimes inappropriate behavior. Sometimes people like to get into fights. Some people like anonymous sex all the time. And I'm not judging these behaviors so much as saying that as a long-term solution to our underlying stress, they don't really work. They're just what's known as band-aids. They distract people for a while, but the underlying cause doesn't go away. And in fact, often the causes grow worse, and often these behaviors, when they become addictive, can isolate us and can lead us to a place in life where we really can't be useful friends, co-workers, or whatever, because we become more and more addicted to our easy way out tools. And other examples are, of course, I was reading a couple of things online about people who use steroids rather than just, you know, are patient and go to the gym all the time and understand what the body is capable of developing over time. They try to sort of jumpstart at an incredible detriment to their livers. Steroids are really quite dangerous, and many athletes have died from liver cancer as a result. And I was reading an article also on BBC about women who, after childbirth, went through liposuction rather than being patient about their body returning to its pre-pregnant state. And some of them died, because liposuction is a very dangerous operation at times. So there's a sort of cultural addiction to the quick way out. And then on top of it, we also like the things that are the easiest and most familiar. A lot of times people come to Buddhist sanghas and we want Buddhism to be a very convenient, easy to grasp immediately, and we want it to be the way we sort of have hazily caricatured it in our minds. A lot of people have been very disappointed to find out that the Buddha didn't teach the idea of a cosmic self out there, that he wasn't some sort of hippie living 2,500 years ago, that he didn't teach Buddha nature, that in fact he said everything that's positive we have to slowly cultivate over time. It's even sort of funny when you look up patience in the dictionary. Well, not the dictionary. I looked it up on thesaurus.com just to see what would come up, because I actually don't own a physical dictionary. I used thesaurus.com, and the first words that came up were bovine, resigned, and sedate, which brings to mind a cow about to be slaughtered, which is culturally not really far off from what a lot of us think when we hear the words be patient. We think, oh my God, that's another way of somebody saying I'm not going to get what I want. When I was a kid, but when my parents said be patient, that was almost certainly what it meant to me. It meant I was not going to get whatever it was I was nagging them endlessly about. I remember one year I was nagging them about getting a bass guitar because I had in my mind that if I could join a little punk rock group, that I would suddenly, all of my social awkwardness and my lack of a girlfriend and all that would immediately be cured by the presence of a bass guitar in my life. So I hampered and assaulted them verbally for months on end. And my mom would say, well, be patient, which was, to me, what you say to somebody when you're going to say, well, you might not get it, you probably won't, you should just put it out of your mind, because there's an excellent chance that come your birthday or Christmas, there's going to be some fucking other presents that you're going to get that has nothing to do with a bass guitar. So we hear... patience, be patient, and we think, oh my God, I'm not going to get fucked with the fuck I want, and so I just have to let go of this, and and of course, none of that has to do with the patience of spiritual practice, because what we do here, which is practice developing lasting calm and peace, is attainable. When we say be patient, I'm not telling you, maybe you'll get it, maybe you won't. I am telling you, you will get it. I'm just telling you, you're not going to get it in the timetable that you wanted. Because I didn't get it in the timetable I wanted. And I've heard from venerable monks who've practiced for years and years and years that it took them a very long time to get to a place where they could have reliable results all the time in their meditation, where they'd sit and they had a practice that was so ingrained and so developed that no matter what was going on in their lives, they could always reliably put it down and have a resource for inner peace. So it's not a way of saying do nothing. It's not a way of saying just give it up. It's not a way of saying it's not important. In fact, it's saying all the opposite. It's saying don't give up. It's very important. And there's a lot of stuff we're going to have to do to attain it. But we're going to have to be reasonable about our expectations. So how does this... Well, one way to understand it is to understand the basic teachings, the foundational teachings of what karma is. Contrary to what you hear on TV and you've heard around word of mouth, karma is not the teaching, what goes around comes around. When I hear that, and it's always explained that way, it just makes me grind my teeth. I should let it go after all these years, but you just hear something that's so not actually what the teaching is, and it's so popularized and so ingrained in the popular milieu that it undermines a real understanding of what karma is. But karma is simply the Buddha's teaching that our thoughts and our actions create the mind you're going to live in. If you think a thought a lot, if you act in a certain way a lot, you're planting the seeds for what your mind will be like in the future. If you think thoughts that are judgmental of other people, if you're judging yourself and other people harshly, well then, in the future, you're going to live in an isolated mind where you're not feeling connected or compassionate or truly part of a world with other people. You're going to feel remote and distant because you've been practicing planting the seeds of judgment and distance, and feeling holier than thou. On the other hand, if you practice thoughts like compassion, generosity, and practice those actions, you're going to live in the future in a mind that's compassionate and generous. Well, what mind sounds better to be living in the future? The teachings are that every thought and every action we take are planting seeds. Now, not all of those seeds will come to fruition. There's some seeds that you might plant, and I'm talking like I know what the fuck I'm talking about. I don't ever plant anything, but assumedly, if you plant seeds, not all of them will grow. Only if you plant a lot of them, they probably will grow. That's another way of saying our habits, our mental habits begin to determine who we are in the long term, right? If you're constantly falling into thoughts of worry, you're going to live in the future in an agitated mind that doesn't feel taken care of, that feels like it's drowning, that feels like you're alone in the world. On the other hand, if you practice cultivating thoughts of appreciation for what others have done or appreciation for what you've accomplished, then you live in a mind that feels a sense of gratitude and feels a sense of abundance. You won't be living in a mind that feels like it's coming from, you know, living without. So this is the basic idea of karma. The thoughts and your actions are planting the seeds for future outcomes. The key is that these seeds take time to come to fruition. Karma is not always, in fact, generally, it's not an immediate result. As farmers, I'm sure, would tell you, although I've never interviewed a farmer, I don't think I've actually even had a long, sustained conversation with a farmer. So I don't really know why I'm flying down this metaphor, but I'm going to keep using it because I'm already drowning in it. So, if you talked to a farmer, he probably would tell you that it takes a while for the seeds that you planted to finally grow. But it's not like it's a practice where you're doing nothing, right? I've heard that farmers' lives are actually a lot of work. They actually have to get up, they have to, you know, do something with the soil. What is that, till? Jesus, this is embarrassing. Why couldn't I have done some other... When I was writing my notes last night, farming sounded so plausible. So you have to till the soil, and you have to work it and do stuff, wake up early. And it's all very exhausting. And eventually you wait, and then something comes out of the ground, and then you got to act very quickly, because if you don't, it'll rot because the sun will do something bad to it, or mice will come along and eat it. I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. But anyway, it's a lot of work, right? It's schlepping about doing things, and that's the idea. This is you're planting in your life through right thoughts on compassion and generosity and goodwill, and by refraining from stealing and killing and practicing harmful sex, which means, you know, cheating or you know, sleeping with your best friend's girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, you're not causing harm. And all these things you're practicing, there's a point to them. They're planting the seeds in your mind for what your mind will grow into becoming. Again, I can't guarantee that every great action you undertake will grow into this wonderful oak in your mind. I don't even know what that means, but it will if you do practice enough compassion, generosity, and certainly meditation, appreciation. It will grow. Your mind will develop something worthwhile. The word for patience in Pali is Kanti. Kanti. And as Ajahn Jeff has reminded me on several occasions, Kanti actually literally doesn't only mean patience, it means endurance. So at the Buddha's time, they understood that patience was literally, it was not going to be easy. You weren't describing a spiritual path where things were going to come, were going to be given. Patience didn't mean, well, just, you know, do as little as you can, and eventually maybe you'll get it. You're not. It means you're going to have to put a lot of effort into it, and there's going to be times when you sit down where the mind is going to be anything but cooperative. There's going to be times when you might have panic attacks or stress attacks. There's going to be times when your brain is agitated and where the thoughts are whirling around, and part of patience or Kanti means recognizing that this practice is one that does bear fruition, but it will take time. There's going to be setbacks. There's going to be times when you, on the path, you're going to hit very difficult terrain. So what are the tools that we use to develop practice? Patience. I'm going to list some of the ones that came up to me when I was thinking of them. The first is to remember or reflect on the fact that there are probably areas in your life where you already do practice patience. If any of you go to the gym and continue to go to the gym or continue to go to yoga or any form of physical activity, you're already probably practicing patience, because unless you're a flaming idiot, you don't go to the gym and the first day expect there to be beautiful muscles. Nor do you go to yoga in the first class expect to be as limber as those ridiculous pictures that all my friends send me of themselves with their legs behind their necks, which just make me feel like the old stiff man that I really am. It will take time to do that. You should see my idea of a downward dog and upward facing cow, whatever it is, upward. Upward facing what?
Dog.
Dog, okay. Mine looks more like an upward facing cow. So anyway, it takes a lot of time. So reflect on the fact that you're already probably practicing patience somewhere in your life. If you have ever learned a musical instrument, trust me, I know how to play the banjo and the accordion, which are two of the most frustrating instruments on the planet. And each one of them I felt many times like hurling out the window. Isn't that a really loserish thing to tell a group of people? And you play the accordion? I mean, I'm just fawn in all of your eyes. But anyway, it takes a long time to develop. As you've learned in your life, anything that's worth, whatever you do for a living probably didn't come immediately. Whatever, you know, whatever tools that you use for, you know, if you play a game like Scrabble, you probably weren't good at it immediately. So there's probably some area in your life where you've seen that in order to become good at it, you've got to put aside the idea that the results will be immediate, that they will be only the fruit of long-term effort. So reflect on this and bring this sense of dedication and this sense of knowing that everything we put our minds to will bear fruit. It's sort of incredible that anything that we do repeatedly over a course of days eventually goes from the frontal cortex into the basal ganglia, which is the motor cortex, and becomes easier and easier and easier. I've read books on this subject. In fact, if you're ever playing tennis with somebody that you want to fuck up, you know they're better than you and you want them to lose, there's a very simple trick that will make them lose. This is great. You come to Dharma Pumps to hear how to make a tennis opponent. Like, I even play tennis, but you ask them before the game to explain very patiently to you how they do their backhand. And by moving the backhand from the basal ganglia back to the forebrain, they're actually taking it out of an ingrained, very compact, economic muscle memory to back to something that they have to think about. They're going to immediately lose their backhand skills. So go forth, young people. That's what you learned today at Dharma Punks. So that's part of it. If you keep repeating something, just know that it'll eventually move into your basal ganglia. It'll eventually become second nature. You'll eventually be able to fall into a meditation much easier. It's funny, when I was sick recently, and I was every night taking some of those Hall's cough drops before I went to bed, and now it's ingrained in me, and I'm no longer sick, but every night I'm still having one of those cough drops before I go to bed, because my brain just has this little alarm clock in it going, you didn't take your Hall's cough drop yet. So it's an addiction I have to get rid of, but not a terrible one. So anything you do for a few months after a while will begin to slowly become ingrained. Now, the second thing is, whenever there's impatience, there's going to be an agitated breath, which means that if you watch your breath when you become impatient in life, you'll notice that it becomes a little bit more staccato, a little more choppy, less deep and slow and smooth. I've spent retreats just like focusing on when I become impatient, and the first thing I'll do is see what's going on with the breath. And I always notice that when I'm becoming frustrated, the breath always becomes a little bit more shallow and fast, or like almost like I'll become slightly hyperventilating. So when you notice you're becoming impatient, one of the next tools we can do is just relax the breath. And then three, find the place in the body that when you're impatient immediately becomes stiff and becomes tense. In my case, it's the stomach and the shoulders. Mostly when it's impatience, it's the shoulders. When I'm in fear, it's my stomach becomes very tight. But when I'm impatient, my shoulders suddenly go up, and sometimes I move my jaw, sometimes I do weird things with my fingers, you know. So it's very important for me to survey the body, find the areas that become stressed, that become tense, and work on relaxing those areas, which almost immediately will take me from the impatient, judgmental thoughts and bring me back to a sort of ground zero again, where I can redouble my efforts. Number four is, when we notice things going wrong, bring a sense of inquisitiveness to what's happening rather than the normal frustration and anger that we bring. When I was a kid, I was teaching myself the bass. When I finally harangued my parents into getting one, I would get really so frustrated and slap the bass it was the bass's fault when I made an error and I couldn't learn something. And it took me many, many years instead to develop this spirit of seeing what went wrong, like looking back and seeing, okay, today my mind is really, really agitated. It's not settling down. What have I been thinking about all day long, or what expectations did I bring into the meditation, or did I do all the normal steps of relaxing the body before I meditated, or what's been going on that I've been focusing my mind too much on? You know, reflecting. I heard a story about a potter from another monk was telling me that there was this student who was studying with this potter for years, and that every time she put her pots in the kiln, the next day they would all shatter. And she thought that his pots always, or whatever they make, clay, what are fucking potters make? Oh my God, this is bad. I don't even know what potters make. Pots, they make pots, whatever. So anyway, she thought his things never, ever shatter. It's just me. I'll never be a good potter. And then one day she came in early, and all his pots had shattered in the kiln. But instead of getting frustrated, he was just calmly looking at the settings and looking at the thickness and looking at the whatever, you know, that he had done to figure out what he could change and experiment with. It's the same thing in the meditation. What thought did I focus on at the beginning of the meditation? Did I have enough practice of goodwill? Did I remember to slow the breath down? Did I remember to check the body? Have I been focusing too much on what other people think or are doing in my lives? Really reflecting and seeing next day if there's one thing we can change in our lives, and see if it makes tomorrow's meditation more peaceful. That's what we call inquisitiveness, rather than just throwing frustration at something. It's instead trying to figure out what went wrong. Number five, from my experience, the most, as I said earlier, and what I encourage you to do either this weekend or 2 weeks from now, is when there's doubt or a lack of conviction, when you notice that there's like this tendency, rather than to meditate, to say, well, I know that meditation is good, but I don't know if it's really going to bring me the results. You know, maybe it just does it for everybody else, or maybe there's, you know, it's not such an important practice, is really hang out with renunciates or with other people who've been practicing for years and years and years, and see what the results are. I guarantee you, if you hang out with somebody who's been practicing meditation for 20 or 30 years, you're going to see somebody who's a lot calmer, a lot more patient and peaceful and open and honest and less reactive than the people you normally run into who don't practice. But you really have to seek them out. I mean, I've been practicing for most of my life, and I still have to go to as many weekend retreats and hang out with as many monks as I can, because it's so easy in this world that's so focused on immediate results to lose track of the fact that this practice, sometimes the pace is very gradual, often glacial, but we will get the results. And finally, not carrying around all the time the goal and comparing where we are with the goal is not the way to do it. What I mean is, if you are moving into a house that's filled with junk, filled with garbage, and you've just moved into this apartment and the last tenants have not cleaned it out, and part of the deal you've made with the landlord for lower rent, whatever, or no fee, is that you've got to clean it out. And you might immediately, in one day, try to clean out everything. And of course that leads to frustration and a sense of giving up. When we try to fix everything in our lives, and we constantly see and focus on how much more work there is to do, there's a tendency to become very frustrated. Often we'll do the exact wrong thing, as we'll try to immediately just spend an entire day doing nothing but, you know, spiritual practice. I've met people who haven't meditated before in their lives, and they'll go on a 10-day Goenka retreat, as if that's the way to gently ease your way into a practice. And invariably, when I meet these people, none of them stay engaged in the practice. They're like, oh yeah, I did a 10-day retreat, it didn't work. I've been practicing for 20 years, and more than 20 years, and it does work for me. But, you know, I never have believed in those 10-day Goenka retreats, because, I mean, they're fine if you've been practicing for a long time, but if you're just going to jump in and drown yourself and expect to be suddenly cured, that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is, as they say in 12-step programs, keep your focus on what's happening right now, right in front of you. What are you working on right now? There's a hill that I ride my bike up in Woodstock to get to this really nice lake, and Cooper Lake. And to get to Cooper Lake, you've got to ride up 5 increasingly steep hills. And by the time you get to the 5th one, I'm always wanting to give up. And I've noticed that the times that I focus on how much further there is to go are the times I give up and get off my bike and walk the rest. But the times I don't look at how far up that the peak is and just look at the road right in front of me and just do the next pedal, and just focus on that, are the times that I succeed. So it's not a matter of constantly comparing where you are with the end goal. It's more a matter of focusing on what you've got to do right now to be peaceful and seeing how far you've come from in the past. Don't judge yourself with perfection. In fact, relish and appreciate the distance that you've come, even if it's small, since the start of your practice. Again, if you start your meditation and you notice that you're not patient, you're not in a place of calm, you're in a place where you have high expectations, just start over. Just start over. And just remember that this is a long practice, but it's a practice that leads to the most valuable tool that anybody, I believe, can acquire. It's a tool that will bring you calmness and tranquility no matter what's going on in the rest of your life, no matter how unskillfully other people are acting, no matter what's going on in the rest of the world, no matter how disappointing people are acting around you. You can have a tool that will bring you tranquility. So that's worth putting in the effort and putting up with the endurance. So that's tonight's talk, and thank you for listening. So now it's your turn to ask any questions about anything else or anything that has to do with spiritual practice. And I'd be happy. Hi.